I have the opportunity now to introduce Rabbi Norman Cohn. Rabbi Norman Cohn is the provost of the Hebrew Union College, which is my alma mater and my wife's alma mater and soon to be Daryl Lerner's alma mater in a year or so. And there are four campuses of the Hebrew Union College. Every student spends their first year in Jerusalem. And then you can go 4 years to Los Angeles campus, 4 years to the Cincinnati campus, or 4 years to the New York campus. Rabbi Cohn has spent his time with the College Institute at the New York campus, and Stacia and I had the privilege of studying at the Los Angeles and Cincinnati campus, so we never got to have Professor Cohn as a teacher until we became rabbis, and then we got to study with him at many conventions and in many other settings. Even more than that, having him as a professor, my wife was lucky enough to also have him as a boss for 6 years when she worked at the Hebrew Union College as the director of outreach. I was the rabbi in Cincinnati for 6 years at the Isaac M. Wise Temple, which is where Rabbi Wise was and founded the institutions of Reform Judaism. So it was not uncommon for professors and even the president of the College Institute to be members of my congregation. I would never suggest that I was their rabbi, but they were certainly congregants in the congregation. And whenever one came into the building, I always felt like I was in class again. And that's a wonderful feeling because this is an opportunity for learning and for growth always. And they were always very ready to help me grow. Let me tell you. Even more than that, though, in our tradition, we're to say a blessing when we're in the presence of a scholar, a Torah scholar. And Rabbi Cohn's presence here is a blessing to all of us, as you will soon see. So with no further ado, I'd like to welcome Rabbi Dr. Norman Cohn, provost of the Hebrew Union College.
Shavua Tov. Or as we said in the back, good vach, a good week. And this has been just an extraordinary, extraordinary Shabbat for me. When I left New York on Tuesday, it was 35 degrees. I said to my wife, this is a very hard job, but someone has to do it. Well, I'm happy to report that when I fly back tomorrow, it's supposed to be 65. So maybe we're finished with next to the worst winter we've ever had in New York City. An extraordinary Shabbat from many perspectives. I'm just sorry that my wife, Terry, couldn't have shared it. She would have loved it. Last night at University Synagogue, it was absolutely wonderful with Rabbi Rachlis. And today at B'nai Israel with Rabbi Spitz, this Shabbat has been a treat for me. I told a story at the B'nai Israel this morning. I'll repeat it because it really is a perspective on what the experience has been. In both places, after the teachings, people just couldn't stop talking, and it was a kind of very Jewish experience. People talking at me from different, in the Oneg Shabbat and in luncheon today, just a plethora of voices kind of flowing over me, and I told the story of Norman Lamb, who is the president, or actually now the chancellor of Yeshiva University, who one day was approached by a donor who wanted to give $1 million to create a crew team at Yeshiva University, a rowing team. Lamb just thought it was absolutely hysterical. But when he went to the rabbis in the yeshiva of Yeshiva University, they told him, listen, take the $1 million, create the crew team. Maybe the guy will give $1 million to the medical school or the law school or the yeshiva itself. So he took the $1 million and he created the crew team. He bought the best skulls, the best boats that money could buy. They bought new uniforms, appropriately blue and white. They named themselves the Maccabees. They built a crew house on the Harlem River. It's not such a big river. In Upper Manhattan. And they hired the best crew coach that they could find in the United States, and they began to train. About 2 months into training, they decided that they would row against the Harvard crew just to see how much progress they made. So they went up to Cambridge and rowed against the Harvard heavyweight crew, and they came in 22 boat lengths behind. Lamb said, when am I supposed to tell the donor? You know, it was a shanda. So he decided to send the crew and the coach up to Cambridge to see what they could learn from the Harvard crew in terms of training, all of that. A week and a half later, the crew comes back. Lamb asked them, well, what did you learn? He said, do you know, in their boats, one person speaks, eight people row. It's, you know, I say that about all the stories. It's my favorite stories. I'm just grateful to be here tonight to the Jaffees for their wonderful hospitality, to Rabbi Steinberg and to Rabbi Stacia Deutsch, and especially to Ari Katz, energetic, indefatigable coordinator of this Community Scholar in Residence program, Scholars program. If my experience just in one day is anything like the program as it is, I'm sure that Shai Gaffney and others just go back in awe of what can be achieved in a community. And it really is because of people like yourselves, those of you who are not only the students but the patrons and supporters of the program. So I really do thank you in the name of all of the teachers who have an opportunity to share Torah with you in this format. It really is a wonderful comment on the nature of the community and what people can achieve. And it's really an opportunity for me to share what is one of my great loves in life, and that is this wonderful world of Midrash. My introduction to this florid world of rabbinic interpretation of the Bible came at a very, very tender age. I grew up in New York City in Queens in a place called Astoria, right near the East River, in a time when it was actually Irish and Italian and not Greek. Today it's the second largest Greek population center in the world. Great food, by the way. And had the wonder of growing up with my paternal grandfather who lived with us during my teenage years. He was a figure larger than life. He was about 4'11". And in our family, we affectionately called him Shorty. Shorty had one goal. It was an Orthodox family. And that was on Saturday afternoon to get me to come back to shul with him for the afternoon and the evening service. He was like the Shomer Hatat. He would place himself at the door. I was trying to sneak out to the schoolyard to play basketball. And he would try to chop me, grab me to come to shul with him. And he would say, Norman, you'll come with me to shul. And we'll have Shalashutis, the wonderful Su'uda Shalishit, this mystical third meal that traditional Jews consume in the synagogue, where I learned not only to drink schnapps, but to eat matzah's herring and herring and cream sauce in a very pre-cholesterol conscious era. And he would say, you will have Shalashutis, which the rabbis, by the way, interestingly rationalize as a kind of taste of the Messianic banquet. You should know that when Messiah comes and we sit down at the Messianic banquet, fish is going to be on the menu. And we'll study Medrash. My grandfather called it Medrash, and I call it Midrash, and Christians who study this biblical interpretation call it Midrash. Whatever it wasn't something that my Lithuanian grandfather resonated with. He was a Litvak. He was very rational. If you asked him to define his Judaism, he would tell you that you had to study the Talmud, right, the code of law. Or if pushed a little bit, maybe the medieval code of literature, the Shulchan Aruch, the Tur and others. But this world of Midrash, of interpretation, where the rabbis tell us, and you should know, that Adam kept kosher. And Isaac actually studied in a yeshiva. And Moses and Rabbi Akiva, who lived 2,000 years apart, actually spoke to one another. World that my Litvakisha grandfather didn't understand. But, and here's the kicker. In those moments when he succeeded in schlepping me to shul on Shabbos afternoon, this afternoon and evening Mincha and Ma'ariv service, and you had to do something for the 45 minutes before it got dark, so it was a kind of intermezzo, you know, between the appetizer and the main course, you would study. And I, to this day, remember the moment sitting next to my grandfather in that chavrusa, in that chavruta, in that study session, when someone would say something, a word, really a vort, an insight, if you will, and it would seemingly pierce my grandfather's heart, mind, and soul. I would look at my grandfather, and his face would alight like Moses coming down from Mount Sinai. Whatever was said, that insight into the text clearly transformed him, clearly made him other, clearly uplifted him. And I know as a teenager when I was 13, 14 years old, I just wanted to feel that way. I wanted some way to gain a sense of the power of the texts of the past, that they wouldn't remain kind of remnants of the ancient Near East, but somehow could touch us and transform us as human beings and as Jews, as husbands and wives, as children, as parents, as siblings, as lovers and friends. And from that moment on, I sought that path back to the text. And for me, the path was Midrash, this world of interpretation, because the core of what Midrash is all about is really finding contemporary meaning in the text. The word Midrash comes from the Hebrew word Lidrosh. Lidrosh in Hebrew means to seek, to search, but even more importantly here, to demand. To demand that Torah text speak to us in a voice that somehow can respond to the essential questions that we ask. Questions of meaning. What does it mean to be a human being created in God's image? What's the role of human beings in this universe? How do you bring tikkun, repair, to a broken world? How do you move metaphorically from Egypt, from Mitzrayim, from Mitzarim, the narrow places, to God's place? And that was the role of Midrash, somehow giving us insight so that we can make the journey through the desert of our lives, individually and corporately, to God's place, to the mountaintop, to be touched by the insights of the tradition that could make a difference in our lives. And so I craved this world of Midrash and began to study it. And in order to study Midrash, you only have to do three things. It's not rocket science. It calls on a kind of part of the brain that responds to the aesthetic in the world. But you just have to do three things. That's all it is. The first thing is to actually listen to the biblical text. This is not a speed reading contest. Remember religious school, Hebrew school, we played all those games. You didn't understand the word, but you read very, very quickly. If we run precipitately through the text and we try to maximize what we cover in a minimum amount of time, you'll miss the power of every word. Every word, every phrase, every metaphor, every syntactical element in the text can be a hook upon which we append meaning. Every word can be an entree into insight into our souls and into our lives. Second thing is, when you take time with the text, you have to be brave enough to ask all the questions about the text. That's what the rabbis did. Every textual, theological, historical, sociocultural, political, archaeological, every question about the text is a way of finding meaning in the text, of plumbing the depth of the textual experience. But the third piece, when you ask the questions about the text, you have to be willing to ask the most difficult questions about the text. And for human beings in this world, are we okay? Thank you. For human beings in this world, the most difficult questions for us are two kinds of questions. The theological questions: what do we believe in? Do we believe in something more than the material and the mundane? And if we do, what is that force that we call God? And how do we define God in our lives? And what role does God play? And what does covenant mean? And what's the relative roles of God and human beings in the world? But even more so, the most difficult questions are the human questions. To say to ourselves that when we read this biblical text, it is like staring into a mirror. We see characters at the crossroads of their lives in situations which are our life situations. And when we hear their voices and read their words, is as if we're peering into a mirror and seeing ourselves. We find ourselves in the text as we understand this is a story about human beings. They may be mythic in proportion occasionally, but generally they're stories about how human beings interact with each other. And that being the case, I spent the last 20 years trying to write books and doing teaching about how do we find ourselves in the text and what can it teach us about our own life journey. So this evening, in the short time that we have, I want to talk about Moses. But I don't want to talk about Moses who really is the Moses that we kind of identify, you know, more typically. Not Moses the miracle worker whose strong hand took Israel out of Egypt. Not Moses who saw God face to face, panim el panim, who was God's intimate for 40 days on Mount Sinai. Not Moses the warrior who led the Israelites in battle against the Amalekites and the Moabites in the desert. Not even Moses, the poet, who sang Shirat Hayam, the song at the sea, and Ha'azinu at the end of his life, the poetry of Deuteronomy 32. Not Moses, the lawgiver, whose Torah is called Torat Moshe, the Torah of Moses. Not even Moses of the rabbis, Moshe Rabbeinu, if you will. Moses, the teacher, the rabbi. But I want to talk about Moses, the human being. Moses, a simple human being who is frail in certain kinds of ways, who is beset by a number of disabilities that we can identify with, who struggles to find the realization that he can make a difference in the world. It's Moses, the human being, who struggles to be a leader, who struggles to realize that he somehow can be the vehicle that brings Israel from Egypt to the promised land. So, a couple of moments of the text. If you turn to the first page, it should be page 398 on the bottom.
Are there any extra texts? Maybe some people could share because we have people back here who don't have any. Sorry.
I just want us to listen to the text and to hear its words and then take a moment to reflect on it. It's clear that if we had a couple of days, we could still be talking about these passages. We'll try to do it, and since I'm in New York, and speak very quickly. So chapter 3 in Exodus. Moses has fled Egypt. He's now where? He's now with his father-in-law Jethro, right? A Midianite priest, and you talk about a differentiated identity, someone who probably could have used a great deal of therapy. Moses, who was raised in Pharaoh's court as an Egyptian, comes to identify himself with his Hebrew brothers and sisters when he strikes down the taskmaster, flees Egypt, winds up in a Midianite household, married to a Midianite woman whose father was a priest of Midian. And you wonder who Moses is, what is his identity? What kind of baggage does he bring to the moment of leadership? And I would suggest to you, any of us who are lay leaders or professional leaders, nay, all of us, have our own baggage as we come to the moment of any life situation. So does Moses. So he's shepherding the sheep of his father-in-law in the desert, in the wilderness. And he comes to, in the first line, he comes to Horeb, which is identified as the mountain of God. And he pauses for a moment and he said, but wait a second. Horeb, I thought Sinai was the mountain of God. Why Horeb? Well, the scholars struggle to think of the identity of Horeb. Is it the same as Sinai? Are they two distinct mountains? It's not very, very clear. But calling it the mountain of God clearly at least is a kind of anticipation that one day Moses will come to Sinai and will be touched by God's teaching. So he drives the sheep into the flocks into the wilderness. He comes to the mountain of God. In verse 2, an angel appears to him. Where? In the blazing fire out of a bush. In Hebrew, the word for bush is?
Sneh.
It's an interesting word. First question, of course, is why does God appear to Moses out of a bush? Why the metaphor of a bush? Could the biblical writer not have thought of a more appropriate object in which to identify the divinity and the Godhead? Why the sneh? Why the bush? You thought you were going to sit there quietly. Right? Why the bush as a place that is identified with God's presence, if you will? Okay, the bush, especially in the wilderness, these scraggly bushes are all over, which then implies that God is everywhere, right? If you frame it in another way, one could say that if God could appear in the bush, certainly God can appear everywhere in the world. God's appearance is everywhere. All it takes for us, if God is everywhere, not just in the bush, and by the way, just as an aside, the word sneh in Hebrew, samach nun hey, is very close to Sinai, samach yud nun yud, the same consonants, as if to say what? The bush is Sinai. The bush is the place where God is met, that God can be met everywhere. And if God could be met everywhere, the only qualification is to sense God's presence, or translated another way, the only qualification is to sense the redemptive presence in the world. The force that makes for holiness is what? To be able to open our eyes to it, to be able to see it. It's the source that makes for wholeness. The possibility of wholeness is all around us. If only we could open our eyes to the fact that it's around us and in us as well, that we possess that potential. So look at the next line. Yeah.
The text says that God appears to him
Belabat Esh.
Right.
In other words, in a Lev, Belabat probably yes. arrives from Lev Esh.
Right.
So no matter where that the fire is, it could be in a, obviously in a dry wood or anything
right.
else. It's
right.
the fire
that's a nice
that
point.
God appears
and, in. And clearly, by the way, when it says a burning fire, Belabat Esh, Belabat Esh, it's also an allusion to Sinai. Because Sinai is beset by the fire and the smoke and the thunder and the lightning. So it's, again, an allusion to the mountain on the one hand, but the fact that the Esh is everywhere, especially in a dry desert, where you see it continually, that God is everywhere on some level, right? But let's keep on going. All you have to do is see it. We haven't gotten to the good stuff yet, so we're going to push forward. The end of verse 2, what does Moses do? Vayar, right, Vayera Malach Adonai, and then it goes on to say in the end of verse 2, Vayar Vehine Hasneboer Baesh. Moses Vayar Ra'a. Moses saw. He sees. He looks, and here is this flame. Right, here is this bush of flame. I would submit to you the most important word in the entire Bible, and especially in Genesis and Exodus, is the word Ra'a, to see. It's not just the physical reality of seeing. It's the issue of understanding. What does Moses understand? In order to see God's, feel God's presence, to understand there's a power in the universe that makes for wholeness, you have to open your eyes to it. It's everywhere around us. It's in us. If only we would understand it. If only we would perceive it. It's the old story of the Passaic River in New Jersey, close to where I live, which in the summer thaw always floods. And so one spring, the Passaic River is flooding. The police do. They send out their rowboats to tell people they better leave their homes because the Passaic River, it hasn't crested yet. It's continuing to rise. So the rowboat comes along. They come to the house. They tell the guy to come out. He said, no, I believe with the perfect faith that God is going to save me. I'm not moving. The next scene is the river rises, right? They send out the motorboats to get the stragglers in. The guy says, no, I'm not going to leave my house. God will never let me die. The penultimate scene is the guy is perched on his roof. The helicopter comes along, drops a rope ladder. The pilot says, grab hold of the rope because you're going to die if you don't leave now. He says, no, God will never let me die. I'm staying. The last scene is he's dead, he's in heaven, he's before the throne of the Holy One, complaining that he believed with a perfect faith that God would protect him, and God didn't. And God's response is, you know, you don't know? I sent you the rowboat and the motorboat and the helicopter, right? As if to say, the possibilities are there if we only open our eyes to it. Just like Abraham opened his eyes and saw the mountain. Or Hagar, when she was banished into the desert, had to open her eyes in order to see the well that would give her sustenance in the midst of the aridity of the desert. So Moses looks and he sees the bush of flame that wasn't consumed. And Moses said, great Bible, I must turn aside. Asurana, verse 3. I must turn aside to look. What Moses had to do, that sight of the burning presence of God in the bush, all Moses had to do was to somehow look at it. And then tradition argues, well, what did actually Moses do? Did he take several steps towards the bush, in his inquisitiveness to see what the bush was? And then there's one great line in the tradition, that all Moses did was turn his head 45 degrees so that he could see the bush. What a great moment of learning, that sometimes all one has to do is just the movement of one's head to appreciate what exists in one's world. And if you simply look straight ahead, all you're going to see is the mundaneness of our life. But somehow, if one can turn aside and leave the mundane for the moment, one can see the possibilities of what life offers us. So Moses saw that the bush was consumed, right, and all of the rest. Now look at verse 4. Here's the key to the Midrash. He turned aside to look, and God called to him out of the bush, yes, in verse 4. And God calls out what? Moshe! Once, second time, Moshe, Moses. And Moses, of course, answers in one of the 14 examples of Hineni in the Bible, about which I just wrote my newest book, Hineni in Our Lives. Moses answers, Hineni. God calls out, Moshe, Moshe. Moses answers, Hineni, here I am. The word of response in relationship, the word of presence. So the first question is, why does God have to call Moses twice? Why the double call? Why Moshe? Why not just Moshe? Why the double call of his name? Why is it necessary? What does it signify? You're the students of the Midrash now.
Moses was so absorbed in the
fire. All right, tantalized by that miraculous sight that he was just oblivious to everything around him. I like it. Kind of had him awaken him to the reality of what the bush was all about. More. Why the double call? When God calls Abraham the first two times in Genesis 22, it's only once Abraham. The third time, it's twice Abraham because he's so involved in fulfilling God's commandment. Why the double call Moshe here, Moses? Why twice?
He needs it.
What?
He needs
why does he need
because
it?
Because he's only involved with what he's seeing. Maybe he has to call him twice because he's involved with the experience.
Okay, he's so immersed in the sense, he said, in the experience, that he has to be able to stay, to take a step back on some level and be able to understand it on a deeper level in the back.
Moses had two identity problems.
Nice, nice.
He was an Egyptian, now he's a Midianite.
Right.
And to get back to who he was, it takes time.
Yeah, well, there are different Moses here at that bush. Is he the Israelite, or is he the other, the foreigner? Which Moses ultimately is going to be spoken to at the bush? So I like your comment very much. Why double Moses?
It's like a parent teaching the child.
That's nice.
Yeah. This is important.
Get its attention. I want to give one more. I like your point. I want to give one more piece of drash here. And that is... Well, he had to give two tablets, and so then on some level it's a doubling of the name as an anticipation of what's going to happen at Sinai. Already we're thinking midrashically. I like that. Judge.
Well, it was way too soon.
We'll get to you in a second.
It was way too soon in time to have Freud's interpretation of Moses.
But we can give it. It won't stop us, right? I think the differentiation of the persona here on some level is an intriguing notion in terms of the double call. I want to add one other thing, if you allow me. And that is Moses, when he hears the first call, can't believe that God is calling him. He's the simple shepherd with the speech impediment who's basically identified as a Midianite or an Egyptian, and he hears this call of the universe, and why in the world would he think that God is addressing him? What he has to be awakened to is the reality that not only is God calling him, but actually calling him. He, this shepherd with this speech impediment, how in the world could it be God calling him? I think it bespeaks Moses' reticence, his own sense of a limited self, his lack of confidence at this stage. It's impossible for God to be calling him, and it takes two calls for him to respond. But he does respond. Even though he may be reticent, he doesn't run away like Jonah. He does say, what? Hineni, here I am. Now, as an aside, I'm going to repeat something I said last night in University Synagogue, because I think it's an instructive metaphor. And that is, when Moses is called by God and he responds, Hineni, Moses has no idea what God wants, right? He has no idea. The task is not yet defined. All he hears is the voice. He feels the impulse of God drawing him, but he doesn't know what God's going to ask of him, yes? The task is yet to be defined. He doesn't know what God is going to ask him. I submit to you, it's the best definition of what Hineni is all about. When we're called by the other in our lives, whether it's God or other human beings whom we love, frequently it doesn't matter what the task is. It doesn't matter what the content is. When someone who loves you calls, the impulse needs to be, I want to respond to you, irrespective of what the call is. And sometimes the content of the call is irrelevant. So I gave the example last night at the University Synagogue, a personal Norman Cohen story. And that is, I'm sitting in my study at the Hebrew Union College, and the phone rings, and it's my father. And my father, stroke victim for about 12 years, rarely got out of the house. He says to me, Normie boy, how are you? I always knew every time he said, Normie boy, he wanted something. So how are you? Everything's fine. I said, Pop, what did you have for lunch? He said, I had a few flakes. I said, you had cereal for lunch? I just went to the A&P the other day shopping, and I brought you all of the cold cuts and the vegetables and the fruit and the milk and the cheese and the bread, and you had cereal for lunch? He said, there's nothing in the refrigerator. It's all gone. Do me a favor. When you finish teaching at the Hebrew Union College, come out to Astoria and go shopping for me. I said, Pop, it's late. I'm tired. No, just it'll take you a few minutes, please. So you go out to Astoria from Manhattan. You slip all the way out to Astoria. You go to 2510 30th Road, where I grew up. You go up to the fifth floor, 5M, which used to say 5M for mommy. The apartment, you make a beeline for the kitchen. You open up the refrigerator, and lo and behold, the entire refrigerator is full of food. And it takes you about one more trip to realize that the request to come to Astoria has nothing to do with the food. It was irrelevant. It was simply an aged parent calling, and all he wanted to hear was his son say, "Sure, Pop, I'll come out to Astoria. I love you, Pop." Sometimes, many times, the call and the response of Hineni has nothing to do with the content of the request. All it has to do with one human being wanting to hear someone whom he loves or she loves say to him, "I love you, Pop. I'll be there for you." So the call is made, Moshe, Moshe, and Moses responds, Hineni, in one of these 14 Hinenis, right? And then God says, "Don't worry, remove your shoes. I'm the God of your father Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob," right? You're sitting on holy ground. And in the end of verse 6, Moses, who saw God face to face on Mount Sinai, says what? Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look. The young Moses is not ready to meet God. He's reticent to meet God. So what does God do? He spends the next paragraph assuring him, "Don't worry, I'm going to take your people out of Egypt. I've heard their plight. I'm going to bring them to the land of milk and honey." And guess what? Verse 10. Surprise, Moses. "I'm going to send you to Pharaoh, and you shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt." Listen to verse 11 on the next page. It's so powerful. What does Moses say? "Mi anochi ki elech el paro." Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Who am I? And I submit to you, there Moses is every person. He's every one of us. Every one of us who says, "How can I change the world? Who am I?" Every one of us on some level, if you want to talk about a psychological set, we all suffer one way or another from the imposter syndrome. If only they would discover what I'm not. God thinks I'm going to be the leader, the shepherd, to take the people to the promised land. God should only know who I am, right? When I was the dean of the New York School before I became the provost, and I still haven't figured out yet what provost means, actually. Actually, the second definition of provost in Webster's is the keeper of the prison. So I tell the faculty and the students of the Hebrew Union College, the only question is, who are the inmates? When I was the dean of the New York School, right before the ordination ceremony, I would spend 2 hours with the rabbis and the cantors, and I would ask them one question: "What is your greatest fear?" And for 2 hours we spoke. And to the person, cantor, rabbi, male, female, young, old, it didn't make any difference. The comment that they made was, "They will discover out there that I don't know as much as they think I know. I don't believe as strongly as they think and hope I believe. They're hiring me. They don't even know who I am. Wait till they discover what they're getting in this new rabbi." And I submit to you, every one of us feels that way, whether it's in our professional lives or even in our personal lives. Those who love us should only know about the other side of Norman Cohen, that yetzer hara, that evil instinct. "Oh, I mask it very well," but they should only learn, right? Okay. So we all say, "Mi anochi, who am I?" to be able to step forward and to change the world. Then what does God do? Spends an entire rest of the chapter trying to assure Moses of exactly what's going to happen. God lays out the entire itinerary from the beginning to end. You're going to come to Egypt, the plagues, you're going to redeem them, you're going to get all the stuff from the Egyptians before you leave, and you're going to be redeemed in the middle of the night. Look at page 401, the beginning of chapter 4. With all of that, what does Moses say? "Hein lo yaminu li." As my grandmother would say in Yiddish, "Segur nisht helfen," that you're with me. They're not going to believe me. "Hein lo yaminu li, velo yishmu bekoli." And they're not going to listen to my voice. Why should they listen to me? I can't even speak. Moses, the simple person, struggling to perceive himself as having the ability to become a leader. Yes? Now he is great Midrash. Moses, God's response to Moses, just listen. When he says they're not going to listen to me and not going to believe me and all the rest, what does God say to him? Verse 2. God says two words in Hebrew, just two words. I think the most important two words in the entire Bible. Ma'zeh biyadecha. What do you have in your hand? yad meaning hand, meaning power. Do you recognize the power that you possess? It's right there in your hand. All that you need to free the Israelites, to move through the water to the mountaintop, to make the world better, is right there in your hand. It's the what? It's the mate, it's the rod, the symbol of my presence, really the symbol of your power, because it extends your hand as far as it will go. You possess the power, but you just don't see it or feel it. It's right there in your hand. It's in your yad, if you only understood. And I'm going to give you all the tricks so you can show the Egyptians. You throw the rod on the ground, you pick it up, it turns into a snake, you pick it up by the tail, it turns back to the rod. I'll give you the hand in the bosom trick. You put your hand into the bosom, it turns into white scales, you pull it out again. And now listen, the great Bible. Really, and this is my Shavua Tov gift to you. Verse 10, after all is said and done with God's assurances and a real sense that Moses has the power to change the world, verse 10 on the bottom. What does Moses say to God? Oh God. Lo ish divarim anochi. I am not a person of divarim, of words. The same Moses who's going to give the divrei Torah, the words of Torah to the people, says in the beginning, I am not a person of words. Ki kavad peh ukavad lashon. My tongue is heavy, I can't speak. I can't speak, I have a speech impediment. Lo ish divarim anochi. And this, to me, is my most powerful verse in the entire Bible, for my own person. I'll tell you one. 7 years ago, I'm sitting with a potential donor at the Hebrew College. And we're having lunch in my office. Pick up a cup of Diet Coke. I go to drink it, and it spills over the entire suit, shirt, all the fears that I have that my wife comes and engenders in me. You gotta look good, you know. Coke is all over the front of my shirt. I go to the bathroom, and I look in the mirror, and lo and behold, the entire right side of my face is frozen, and I have Bell's palsy. And I couldn't speak, and I had Bell's palsy for about 3 months or so. This was in January. There were no classes going on. 2 weeks later, I had to teach the first class of the second semester, and I was worrying about it for how in the world can I get up in front of a class and actually teach and speak? Norman Cohen, he prides himself about being articulate and outgoing, all that stuff, and now I can't say a word. The night before the class, I had a dream. And in the dream, I heard myself saying, Lo ish devarim anochi. I'm not a person of words. I can't speak. Ki kvad peh. My mouth doesn't work. And in the dream, I heard God respond to me. The words in the text, that's the next line, verse 11. What does God say to Moses? Mi sam peh l'adam. Who gives the human being a mouth? If you think, Norman Cohen, that the power is yours, that the authority and the power comes from you, think differently. You're just a vehicle. Doesn't matter whether you can speak well or you can't speak well. If you believe what you're teaching and if you're passionate about it and this comes from your soul, the power is going to come from another place. What you've been deluding yourself all these years is you thought the power came from you. But here's the moment in time when you're going to learn the greatest lesson, and that the power resides elsewhere. And our whole life is to try to tap into that power and be a vehicle for articulating the lessons that ultimately can change the world. Mi sam peh la'adam. Where does the power come from? And it doesn't come from us. It comes from a different place. So with all of that, and God saying, not to worry, I'm going to be with you, and I'll be your mouth, and I'm going to send Aaron, who's going to be a spokesperson. Last piece in this first passage, we're going to do one more passage. Verse 13, with all of that, what does Moses say? Shalach na biyat tishlach. Verse 13, please send somebody else. Not me, I can't do it. Shalach na biyat. It's the same Moses. By the way, just as a jumping ahead, which we're not going to get to tonight, in chapter 18 of the book of Exodus, when he has to raise up judges and judge the people, right? And Jethro says to him, the Midianite father-in-law, it's the last time anyone listened to his father-in-law, when the father-in-law says to him, you can't do it alone. You know, it's greater than you. You're going to have to empower other people and raise up judges and teachers. You can't be the sole articulator of justice and vision. But what does Moses say? The same Moses who a minute before in the text says, send somebody else, I can't speak. What does Moses say? Oh, they come to me for judging, and I judge between the people. And all of a sudden it's ego. The very Moses who is reticent in chapter 4 and chapter 3, in chapter 18 becomes ego, and God and Jethro are going to have to teach him about empowering other people, that giving up power is real power. That's for another teaching and another time. But Moses is going to have to learn that he has the power to change the world. He has the power to bring Israel from Egypt to the promised land. So one more text, and then we're going to talk a little bit. The next page, I guess, is 479. Chapter 14 in Exodus. The Israelites have escaped from Egypt. They're pursued by the Egyptians. Pharaoh has changed his mind, you remember, right? They're facing the forbidding waters of the Red Sea. They're caught between a rock and a hard place. The water in front of them, the Egyptians pursuing from behind. Look at verse 10. As Pharaoh was drawing near, the Israelites caught sight, they raised their eyes, Vayisu b'nei Israel et Nehem. What did they see? Remember, seeing is so important. All they could see is what? The Egyptians coming from behind. They just went through the 10 plagues where the Egyptians were put down, where God freed them, where God redeemed them. Now the Egyptians are coming, and all they can see and understand is they're in danger. The Egyptians are going to kill them. And so they cry out to God in a very frightened way, Vayitzakakua b'nei Yisrael el Adonai, and they say to Moses in verse 11, Hamiblik farim l'kachtenu lamut b'amid. You took us out of Egypt. Aren't there enough graves in Egypt that you took us into the desert to die? The end of verse 11 and 12. Mazot asita lanu. What did you... Did I say something? Just take a minute. Happened to me in worse places. Mazot asita lanu lahotzianu mimitzrayim. What did you do to us that you took us out of the flesh pots of Egypt? They just left Egypt 2 months ago. They don't even seem to remember the slavery. What did you do to take us out of Egypt? Because they're in the aridity of the desert and they're stationed between the Egyptians and the water, and they're hearkening back to the flesh pots 2 months out of slavery, a slavery of 400 years according to the tradition. If you're not yet convinced, line 12. Ki tov lanu avot et Mitzrayim imutenu b'amidbar. Better to what? To serve the Egyptians then die in the desert, right? And then here comes Moses. In verse 13, Vayoma Mashela Am. What does he say? Al tira'u. Don't fear. Hit yatzvu ura'u et Yeshuat Adonai. Be strong and witness the redemption of God. Ra'ah. See it. Understand it. Moses remembers what happened two hours before. He remembers the plagues. He remembers the redemption and the Exodus. And he's telling the people, just stand by and watch. A kind of passive redemption. All you have to do is have faith and God will redeem you. And here comes Great Bible. And if you're not convinced, what does Moses say? Verse 14, Adonai Elohim Lachem. God will do battle for you. Va'atem. And as for you, you rambunctious group of disbelievers, Tacha Rishim. Just shut up and watch. And now what happens in the text? 5 minutes goes by, nothing's happening. 10 minutes. The TNT movie of the Ten Commandments with Ben Kingsley walking up and down, pacing on the shore of the Red Sea, waiting for God to come and redeem them, and nothing's happening. The next line in the text, take a look, line 15, verse 15, it says, Vayomer Adonai el Moshe, God said to Moses, Ma titzak alai, why are you crying out to me? And he said, well, wait a second, I missed something. 1 minute, Moses is turning to the people and saying, what? Just stand patiently and believe and God will redeem you. The next minute in the text, the next line is, God says to Moses, why are you crying out to me? And you say, we're missing something. There's an interstice in the text, the gap. What happened between the moment that Moses turned to God and said, have faith, to the people, have faith, and all of a sudden, God is saying, you're crying out to me. What happened in that gap? And here comes the Midrash. It's not in your text. This is the Midrash. And you've heard the story of Nachshon, but I want to tell it to you again from the Midrash. At that moment, when nothing's happening, 10, 15 minutes go by, according to the Midrash and a wonderful Midrash in the book of Exodus, what does Moses start to do? He starts to daven. Long, arduous prayers. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Egyptians, and the water, and the promise that you made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob to make us as numerous as the stars, and God doesn't respond. And Moses continues to pray to God, and nothing's happening. At that moment in the Midrash, Nachshon ben Aminadav, his PR agent wasn't very successful. He only got 4 lines in the whole Bible. No, that's not so great, I guess. 4 lines in the whole Bible. He's known as the head of the tribe of Judah, Rosh Mate Yehuda. What does he do? He rips off his clothing and plunges head first. As the tribes are arguing over who should jump in first and no one's moving, Nachshon jumps in into the waters of the Red or the Reed Sea. Could have been a huge sea. Could have been a little puddle. One problem. Nachshon's parents never studied the Talmud. Well, it wasn't written then, but that should stop us.
Details,
right. They never studied the Talmud. They would have known what? One of the three great responsibilities of a Jewish parent is to teach him or her son, child, how to swim. So, by the way, it's interesting where it occurs. It occurs in Masechet Kiddushin, it's the tractate on marriage law in the Talmud. I think the
page
metaphor.
28A.
Huh?
Page 28A.
I'll believe you. I'm glad you're here to tell me. I think the metaphor, by the way, of learning how to swim in the context of laws related to marriage is a great metaphor. Well, maybe they knew that we'd always be right in Laguna Beach or Emerald Bay and right by the Pacific. And so Nachshon's drowning because he never learned how to swim. So what does Moses do? Continues to pray long prayers. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Nachshon, the Egyptians, do something. Listen to the Midrash. This is the gift. What does God say to him? Yedidi Toveya Bayam. My beloved is drowning in the water. Nachshon, the Jewish people. By extension, all of humanity who have to move from slavery to freedom. Vahayam Soger Alav. And the sea is closing. Vahaoyev Rodef. And the enemy, Pharaoh, is pursuing. Vahata Omeidu Marbe. But if you look, you stand there davening? Do something. Do something. Moses, who is every person, now intones the response. Pointing back to chapter 4, he says, Ma biyadai la'asod. What power do I have in my hand? He doesn't remember what God taught him in chapter 4. Remember what God said? Ma ze biyadecha d'mater. He still hasn't learned the lesson yet. Ma biyadai. He's every person who says, what power do I have in my hands to make the water sweet, to bring Israel from Egypt to the promised land, to split the waters of the sea? And what does Moses, what does God say? We come back to the text now. Take a look at the text. What does God say? Two things. Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'yisa'u. In the text in line, on line, the end of line 15. First thing God says is, Daber. Speak to the Israelites v'yisa'u, nasa. And they will travel into the water. They'll move into the water. Your first role is to articulate a vision that will impel them to move. They're not the Jews who never come to synagogue and never participate in communal activities and never appear in adult education and don't support the communal scholars program and all of that. No. If somehow you can command a vision for Jewish life that responds to their search for meaning, they'll act. They'll move. They'll move into the water. They'll take the first step into the water. But, says God, now listen, this is the greatest piece of Bible. What does God add? Va'ata. And as for ata, you. It's a play on Moses' comment to the people, va'atem, and you keep quiet. Now God turns it around. Va'ata. And as for you, Moses, what do you have to do? Harem et matcha unetet etcha al hamayim. You have to act. You have to raise your rod and extend your hand over the water. You want people to move? You want to be a professional or a lay leader in the Jewish community, you want to engage other Jews in a positive sense of what Judaism is all about, you have to be the model. You have to act out of your own capacity to move the people through the desert. That ultimately what the text is saying to Moses is, you want to become a leader, you want to become an involved Jew, the only way you can do that is to understand that you have the power to act in the world, and through your action, you will engage others. I submit to you that this biblical text, this prism through the Midrash, tells us that we have the power to somehow make the bitter waters sweet. We can sweeten the waters of the world by somehow living that power that we have, which is in our hand, which is clearly from a Jewish point of view, living the values and the substance of what Torah is all about. It's very reminiscent of a great story with which I'll end, and then we'll entertain questions and comments. A great story about Joshua ben Levi, who is a very famous 3rd century teacher. He decides one day to go up to Tzfat, so he buys a ticket on an Egged bus, travels up to Safed, and he's walking around the tomb of Shimon bar Yochai, famous 2nd century student of Rabbi Akiva, known as a kind of mystical figure. Who does he meet as he's walking near the tomb of Shimon bar Yochai? Elijah. Doesn't happen every day. Take advantage of it. So he says to Elijah, tell me, when is the Messiah coming? Elijah looks up at Joshua ben Levi and he says, you asking me? Go ask the Messiah. He or she is sitting in the gate of the city amongst the other poor people. First of all, just as an aside, what a great, powerful midrash. Why? In order to discern the messianic in the world, the redemptive, what do you have to do? You have to go to the gate of the city and you have to do what? You have to look into the eyes of the poor people in order to find the Messiah. What a great message. We bring repair to the world when we see the faces of the poor people sitting in the gate of this. What a wonderful message of Tikkun Olam, of repairing the world. When we help those who are in need, we bring the messianic in a sense. Powerful. So he goes to the gate of the city and he finds the Messiah sitting and bandaging his wounds amongst the other poor people. And he looks down at the Messiah and he says in the Hebrew, Adoni matay ataba, when are you coming? Messiah looks up at him and says, Hayom, today. It's Mashiach Zeit, it's the Messianic era. He runs back to his academy, he tells all of his disciples, the Messiah is coming today. And of course, what happens? The day comes, the day goes, no Messiah. The next time he takes the Egged bus, that's fought, and walks around the tomb of Shimon bar Yochai, and he meets Elijah a second time, he complains. He said, I found the Messiah sitting in the gate of the city. By the way, very interesting metaphor too, because the gate of the city is understood as the gate of the city of Rome. So what does that say about universalism and particularism? Another conversation. He says, I found the Messiah. He was sitting in the gate of the city. And he said he was coming today, and he never came. And Elijah says to him, you're the rabbi. You're the midrashist. You teach midrash at the Hebrew Union College in New York. He said, you know you have to look at the end of the verse. The end of the verse in the book of Psalms, which we read in Kabbalat Shabbat, Psalm 95. It says, Hayom, today. Im biko lo tishma'u. If you hearken to God's voice. I submit to you what the Midrash is all about as it interprets the biblical text is, do we hear that voice in the text that ultimately becomes the voice in ourselves that impels us to reach our highest self? That tells us that mazeh biyadecha, the answer is we have the power in our hand to make our relationships better, to make the world around us better, and ultimately to bring the messianic age. If only we would understand that it's all in our hands. And it starts with what? It starts with one human being, Nachshon, who out of his faith and commitment takes the plunge into the water. And what do we learn about Nachshon in the Bible? The name is found in 4 verses. The most intriguing one of all is at the end of the book of Ruth. At the end of the book of Ruth, which we read on Shavuot, right, is the Davidic genealogy from verse 20 on. In the middle of David's genealogy, which is understood as the Messianic genealogy, it's repeated in the New Testament in Matthew and other places. In the middle of the Davidic genealogy, the Messianic genealogy, if you count the names, the middle name in the genealogy is Nachshon ben Aminadav, as if to tell us he's the fulcrum, the vehicle, that brings us from the beginning to the end, brings us from creation to redemption. He's the model that can help us transform the bitter waters of life and return us to the Garden of Eden, whence we were expelled in our youth. How do we find all this stuff? By simply opening our hearts and minds and souls to the biblical text as this prism through this wonderful world of Midrash. So I've had a wonderful Shabbat and a wonderful Shavua Tov, being able to share with you my passion, my love for the text, and I'll be very happy to respond and answer questions.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Cohen, very much. We're going to take questions about either the text or any other subjects about Judaism or the Jewish world. It's important to note that the Hebrew Union College is the oldest institution of higher Jewish learning. Unfortunately, thanks to the Holocaust, which destroyed many of the institutions of higher Jewish learning. But it's important also to note that the Hebrew Union College, under the leadership of Dr. David Ellenson and Dr. Norman Cohn, is in very, very good hands. And we thank you for sharing your wisdom with us tonight and your passion. You are definitely Hineni tonight.
Thank you.
Take your questions.
Only easy questions. If my wife were here, I would be able to refer all the difficult questions to her. It's, by the way, reminiscent of a wonderful Hasidic story, which says that there was an itinerant preacher, you know, in the later Middle Ages, early modern period. A preacher went from town to town and was the darshan, was the preacher on Shabbat in different synagogues. And he had a bal agala, a cart driver who took him from town to town. He comes to the 11th town. The Balagula, as they're approaching the town, turns around to the rabbi and he says, listen, he said, I've heard the sermon 10 times. He said, I can embellish on the sermon even, make it even better. We come to the town. I'm sent to the barn with the animals. You're feted and wined and dyed by the richest family in the town. Let's switch places. He said, I'll be the Rebbe, you be the Balagula. I'll give the sermon. I've heard it enough. I've memorized it. They come to the town. The Rebbe goes to the barn. The Balagula has a sumptuous Shabbat dinner, you know, in the richest home in the town. Gets up on Shabbos morning and gives the drasha, and it's a magnificent drasha. And he's gone way beyond the Rebbe in terms of what the point is. In the Onik Shabbat afterwards, someone raises his hand. And he says, Rebbe, can I ask you a question? The Rebbe, very trepidatiously, the Balagula, very trepidatiously says, sure, you can ask. The guy asks the question, and the Balagula says, such a Norish type, simplistic question. Even my Balagula can answer that question. So don't tell my wife, Terry, the sword that I compared it to the Balagula. Anything you want to
Andy.
Ask.
On 4:14, it says the Lord becomes angry with Moses. Our modern conception of deity is above human emotion.
Right.
And for someone like me, who kind of deals with anger issues all the time, I wasn't kind of comforted by this verse.
Yeah, me too. I think, by the way, I'm sorry.
No, how do you see this?
I'll tell you how I see it. From the very beginning of the story of Genesis, God has a kind of human persona. God emotes, God is susceptible to a kind of relationship and all that entails. And if you look at the book of Genesis, even if you look at specific narratives, the best example of it is what? Is Cain and Abel. God sets up, I'm going to play it out hyperbolically, God sets up the story of Cain and Abel by paying attention to Abel's sacrifices and not the Cain's. And boy, if we had a little time and my brother were here from Houston, we'd be able to talk about the story of Cain and Abel in terms of relationships. God sets it up. Cain complains in the middle of the story about, in the sense that I brought the best that I had. And God says, in Tetiv say, had you done well, there would have been uplift. And you didn't do well, sin count, you got what you deserve. As if he's kind of adding salt to the wound. But by the end of the story, what happens to God? God not only accepts Cain, but protects Cain, places a mark on Cain's head. 2,000 years of general literature talks about the mark of Cain in a negative way, but we know Hebraically that the word oath is used twice or three times in Genesis and Exodus, all the symbols of the covenant, that God marks Cain as a member of the covenant who should be protected by God. And what you see is the model of God as parent changing through the narratives of the Bible. And I find that very comforting to think in terms of, we can also learn from the divinity in terms of growth, in the sense of what ultimately being a parent is all about. So I relate to that, and I write about it in my books all the time. Thank you for asking. I appreciate it. You know, going to kick yourselves. You said I could have asked Cohen a question, but I didn't really.
We love you, Beth.
Huh? Thank you. I appreciate it.
It doesn't have to be about the text, about anything.
Whatever you like to ask. My pleasure. And if not,
I have a question.
Yeah, I get buses in business that long.
The what?
Egged buses.
No, egged buses. They seem to go back 1,800 years. Yeah. Egged buses. Yeah.
When God speaks to Moses, he says, "Tell the Israelites to go into the water." It's
no different. The Israelites are then a tool for God to then.
I like that very, very much.
It's no different than Moses using the rod or pouring the water or having the leprosy. The Israelites are then his tool. And this is a demonstration for the Egyptians.
I think it's very well said. I would just add a nuance to it. Human beings have to understand that we are the vehicle. We're the tool. We're the vehicle. We're not the end point of it. Even Torah, on some level, is the vehicle and not the end point. We have the ability to be the vehicle that ultimately carries the world from, you know, creation to redemption. Somehow it has to do with the definition of covenant, if you will. If only we would understand our power to be the vehicle. And many of us despair of that. We look around the world today, a world beset by the kind of the trauma of violence and pain in so many forms, and we just despair of any possibility of making any changes. The world will be what it is. It's never going to change. It'll never get better. There'll always be war. There'll always be fighting, all of that kind of stuff. And I think these texts tell us that somehow we can transform the bitter waters if only we live in a certain kind of way. So it's a very positivistic view of the role of people as symbols on one hand, as you talk about it, but as real vehicles of the other of transformation to some extent in the world. Yeah, I'll get to you in a second.
Did God purposely pick someone who didn't seem to have leadership qualities, or was it random? Is there any teachings on
I believe that, you know, it's not random at all, in the sense that there's an intelligence behind the biblical writers framing their narratives in the way that they do. The choice of Moses, who was every person, and that's why I wanted to emphasize this aspect of it, I think is a brilliant choice. Because it's a Moses who leads the people through the desert to the promised land, doesn't get into it, but he is every person in some way. He struggles through his entire life. Look at the end of his life, Numbers chapter 20, the best example of all, Moses the brother. Miriam dies. The next verse in Numbers 20, right after Miriam dies, says, and there ain't no water. Miriam dies, the water's gone, and the whole midrash about there was a well that mythically accompanied the Israelites for the 40-year journey, and it was Miriam's well, and when she died, the water disappeared, the well disappeared. Moses doesn't have a minute to mourn his sister. The next verse says, and the people complain, there was no water, how are we going to survive? And what does Moses do? It's so powerful. He picks up the rod. And he does what? He strikes the rock twice. By the way, interestingly, it was okay to strike the rock twice in Exodus 17 at Rephidim before Sinai, because you could use power to bring the redemptive. But after Sinai, you have to talk to the rock. Moses picks up the rod, strikes the rocks, and says, Shimuna Hamorim, listen up, you rebels. And you look at the word Morim in the text, and it's Mem, Resh, Yud, Mem, with the O, the Vav left out. And if you just change the vowels, because they're dealing with an unvocalized text, Mem, Resh, Yud, Mem is Miriam. As if to say, you who didn't let me mourn my sister, you did all of this. And he's just a human being who lashes out at the people because they didn't give him the room to be a, you know, to be the brother. Moses is the human being. And I think that choice of Moses as the human being is an exquisite choice, because it invites us all into the text. It invites us all into the text. So I thank you for asking the question. You had a hand up on the side.
Yeah, if the people are the vehicles, or the tools,
right,
the Torah is the vehicle, then what is the end?
Well, it depends. You know, a good Jewish answer, it depends. It depends on which Jewish source you read. On some level is, you know, how do you define the Messianic? It can be a time of wholeness and completeness where we live out the covenant fully. It can be a time when, from a traditional point of view, you know, they talk about the Messiah coming. I happily, as a Reformed Jew, like the notion of Messiah. I love the notion that at every single bris, or now Brit Banot, the naming of a girl, we kind of talk about, you know, Elijah and the Messianic. Why? Because what it does is frame the notion of every single human being can have a kind of a Messiah-like role in the world. We can be the one person who, in a sense, makes a difference, yes? So it depends upon the source that you read in terms of what's the eschatology? How do you frame the end of days? Is it Israel living on its land and everyone coming to the mountain and coming to Jerusalem? All the peoples will be gathered. Is it people will simply come to a wholeness themselves? You know, My grandfather believed, you know, he thought the Messiah was going to come on Tuesday. And that's what the tradition said. Yom Shlishi was the messianic day. So what did he do on Monday night? He put his talis and tefillin bag by his bed, just in case in the middle of the night the Messiah would come, he'd be ready. But you know the irony is? The traditional Judaism, the sources tell us when the Messiah comes, you ain't going to need your talis and tefillin because they are only vehicles. Ritual was only a way of getting to that wholeness in the world. In the end. So what is it? It depends on the source that you read. From my point of view, as I talk about it, I'm talking about repairing each human being to achieve his or her wholeness. And that's ultimately what I see in terms of what the Messianic is, a world where every single human being can step up to the reality of the wholeness of their lives and live it out totally. Will we ever get there? We keep on working.
With Moses being every man and being beset by problems, of what use was his time as prince in Egypt or in the Pharaoh's household? Why was he so insecure after having already been prince of Egypt?
Well, look what happened when he stepped away from the palace in Exodus chapter 2, you know? He goes out to his brothers and sisters, and by the way, there the word ra'ak comes four times. He sees them, you know, he understands who they are, he's one of them. And he intervenes and kills the Egyptian, right? The next day, what happens to him? He goes out and sees two Israelites fighting. And he intervenes, and they look up at him and they say, "Mi samcha shofet aleinu? Who made you the judge?" Right? So here's this youth who grew up in Pharaoh's palace with a sense of authority and power, and the minute he engages with flesh and blood human beings, he realizes it ain't so easy to affect authority. I would submit to you, nothing has changed. It's we Rabbi Cantor educated types or congregational leadership types who have the vision for what the community should be, and then you start to try to make it happen. You realize, well, you got to kind of process it through the community and the board and people and all the rest. The transition for Moses is startling. From the palace dweller to the person who has to flee, because not only has he killed the Egyptian, but in a sense he's been rejected by his own people. So that transition begins to set Moses up for the burning bush story, why he's so reticent at the bush, I think, you know?
Because another metaphor, that is that every, especially Jewish family, we raise our children as little princes and princesses, right?
No, we don't do that.
And so when they get out in the world, they realize they're not a prince and they're not a princess. Many of them just run.
I told a story today at the B'nai Israel. I got over being a little prince when my brother was born. I lived in a one-bedroom apartment in Astoria. My parents, as good Jewish parents, gave me the bedroom when I was born, and they lived in the living room. 6 years later, Marvin comes on the scene. He gets the bedroom. They're still in the living room, and where am I? My parents decide that they're going to make the kitchen into a bedroom. They drop a blind, so the kitchen and the dinette are two different rooms, and I'm living in the dinette. I awaken to the reality of what real life was all about. You think I've gotten over it totally in terms of my brother? Well, wait till we talk about Cain and Abel the next time.
Although the Midrash is really a treasure of thought, but it really actually elicited a reaction, and that was the Parshanei Apshat, a whole series of movement that really threw everything out and looked at the language in differently than you have been looking at, by looking at the text, the grammar, the some in the Rambam, Rashi, the Rashbam.
I think your comment is well taken. Midrash kind of is superseded by commentary on the text. But there are two realities about Parshanut, about commentary, starting with Rashi. Take a look at Rashi. 80% of Rashi is an anthologization of Midrash. He quotes the Midrash, even though he focuses on the individual words of the text, he really is quoting Midrash. And by the time you get to the later commentaries, they're even in certain ways more florid than the Midrashes themselves. When you look at the philosophic commentaries of the Middle Ages, for example, they go way beyond whatever the Peshat, they think they're giving us Peshat, but they go way beyond whatever the simple meaning of the text is.
The Ramban
and beyond. You know what the fact is? Midrash is differentiated. There are some Midrashim which are exegetic. What does exegesis mean? You read meaning out of the text. You start with the words of the text, and you pull out meaning that's latent in the text, right? There are other midrashim that are more narrative, kind of eisegetic. You read meaning by recreating the narrative line into the text. You know what the bottom line is for me? Any single person who's reading a text, it doesn't have to be the Bible, it could be the New York Times, it could be Shakespeare. When we read a text, ultimately we're prisming the meaning of that text through our own lives. And the meaning we find in the text comes out of, to some extent, comes out of us. I'll give you the best aesthetic example. You have a painting on the wall, beautiful paintings. And you have invited tonight the artist to come to study with us. And you say to the artist, tell me what you think about that picture. He says, well, what do you think? And you go around the room and you ask everyone to give us the meaning of the painting, and we write it down on a piece of paper, and you know, lo and behold, there's not one interpretation that's the same. Everyone sees something different, and it's as powerful for each person, even though they see something different. Then you turn to the artist and you say, tell me, what's the meaning of the painting? And the artist looks at the painting and says, well, when I painted the picture 10 years ago, I thought I was saying X, but now that I look at it, and meaning changes. The aesthetic response to a text, be that text artistic or words or whatever, changes over time based upon the context of the reader. That's why we read the Parsha every week, and we repeat the cycle every year, because you come to the text anew. Why? Because you're different every time you read the text. So I agree with you, there's a change. But it really, ultimately, is about reading. If you want to read a good book, a guy named Wolfgang Isser, I-S-E-R, The Art of Reading, Wolfgang Isser. It's German translated to English. Powerful, powerful. What he says is, meaning occurs when the reader and the text become one. It's not just the text, it's not just the reader, but at the moment that the life of the reader meets the text, at that moment, meaning is created. Which means what? Every single one of us are agents to create meaning from the text. Powerful stuff. It's a challenge for all of us. Anyway, I thank you. This is one moment.
I just want to take this opportunity to thank Karen and John once again. Karen, don't leave. Thank you very, very much. Really. I think there's more cookies left. There are more cookies left and more wine and coffee, so please help yourself and schmooze and have a great time.